Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was a good person for 6 months. That's like 5 years. And it felt okay, but not as good as I thought it would. And what did I get for it?
Ah, see, now you're talking about moral desert.
Exactly. Wait, I am what?
Moral desert is the concept that if you act with virtue, you deserve a reward.
Right. If I'm not gonna get rewarded somehow with like a tiara or one of those diagonal word belts.
Sash.
Sure.
Sash.
Then why should I do good things?
That's a clip from the acclaimed fantasy comedy series, The Good Place. Michael Schur is the show's creator. He's also the co-creator of Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. If you noticed that there were a lot of philosophical references on The Good Place, congratulations, you're forking right. And it was Michael who put them there. He's been interested in ethics for his entire life, and now he's channeled that interest into an entertaining, enlightening, and inspiring book called How to Be Perfect, The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question. He explains heady concepts like utilitarianism and my personal favorite, existentialism, with his suitably Schur-esque sense of humor. Michael joined us from New York for a perfect conversation where he described his own super lame behavior, which inspired The Good Place and his book.
I caught myself doing something odd at a Starbucks near my house where I would go in and order a medium coffee. It was $1.73. I would pay in cash and then I would throw the 27 cents into the tip jar, as many people do. But one day I realized that I didn't just do that. I waited until the barista had turned around to see me do it, meaning that I craved some kind of moral credit or something for such a pathetic tip. And I started interrogating myself and wondering why I did that. What was I after? What did I want out of that transaction? Why would I, you know, a tip is ostensibly a thank you to the person who has provided you a service, not a thing that you get credit for, right? So
exactly.
So I just started sort of wondering and talking to people and reading stuff about what it was that I was after. And I sort of stumbled on this idea that I write about in the book called moral desert, which is the feeling that we want credit when we're good people, which is a really fascinating topic that I think is very universal.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of that Seinfeld episode in which George takes the money he put in the tip jar out of the tip jar.
You got no credit.
Exactly. It's like I'm throwing a buck away. I mean, if they don't notice it, what's the point?
So you don't make a habit of giving to the blind?
Not bills.
Yes, that I had never seen that episode. And then when I wrote about this, someone said like, oh, there was a Seinfeld story about this. I went back and watched it. And it was weirdly encouraging to me because I thought like, well, the moments in writing the show The Good Place or this book that I have felt the happiest about were the ones that seemed to be the most universal, that where I had stumbled onto something or tapped into something that a lot of different people feel. And so the fact that there was an episode of TV about this 20 years ago made me feel like, oh, okay, I'm not alone here. This is a thing that many people have experienced, which I think is really ultimately the point of the book, is to try to pinpoint these little weird things that we all do and asking the question of why we do them.
Mm-hmm. And you do it so very well and with a great deal of humor, which is not surprising coming from you. How much did you know about moral philosophy when you came up with the idea for The Good Place?
I had what I would call a Wikipedia-level understanding of it. Like, I had taken a couple classes in college and didn't remember much from them. And I had, at various times in my life, I had done something and thought, like, why the hell am I doing that? And then poking around and reading some stuff. It was definitely the situation that I needed to do a lot of reading and a lot of studying leading up to writing the show before I felt like I could really write it properly.
Now, you got a long way to go to pull this off. It will take hours and hours of studying ethics and moral philosophy. We're gonna have assignments and quizzes and papers. It's gonna be so much fun.
Remind me what I'm getting out of this again.
You get to avoid eternal damnation.
Oh yeah, right. Hey, I got you a present.
What?
Senegal.
That's not a present. That's just common decency.
Yeah, but I fork and nailed it.
So the show accelerated what was a sort of latent or quiet interest that I had had at various points in my life.
Sounds like you needed a cheaty. So what did you do? You talked a bit about it, but can you tell us a bit more about like which works you read and how they helped you?
Yes, absolutely. I started with a book called Justice by Michael Sandel. That was a very popular class in college that I never took. I wish I had. And he wrote a book that it sort of is an overview of the main theories of justice or ethics from the Western philosophical world over the last, couple thousand years. There are a bunch of other books that served as sort of entry points or overviews. I talked to this started on the show later, but I had a lot of conversations with a couple professors, one of whom was named Todd May, who became a sort of official philosophy advisor on the show. The joke that we had was that there was a red phone in the writer's room at The Good Place that we could pick up, like, Reagan calling the Kremlin and say, there's a philosophical emergency. We need your help. He also helped me with the book. He was a sort of the philosophical advisor for the book as well. And then a woman named Pamela Hieronymy, who taught at UCLA, was a huge help and talked to the writers a bunch and helped me and read the first four chapters of the book. And so it was a combo platter of reading a bunch of stuff, including the original texts of Aristotle and Mill and Bentham and a bunch of people like that. And then also talking to these people who do this professionally and could really sort of break them down for me.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea, combo platter. So it was kind of all you can read.
That's
combo
right.
Combo platter. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant is a big influence on Chidi and The Good Place. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Chidi, we wanted the character of Chidi to be the most kind of concerned, obviously, with ethical behavior. He was a professor of moral philosophy in his life on Earth, and he suffers from something that a lot of ethicists suffer from, which is a sort of paralysis.
It would be easier to sort out the issue of dry erase versus paper if I could write down the pros and cons for each. But, of course, I would have to use one of them to write down the pros and cons for them, which is problematic.
Wow!
Ethics team, how's it going?
Terribly.
Cool. Well, you guys are kind of my last hope, so that's not great. Hey, do you mind if I borrow Professor Stomachache here for a second?
Please, take him for an hour. Take all the time you want.
So we wanted Chidi to be Kantian because his main sort of Achilles heel in his life on Earth, all of the human characters on the show had a sort of Achilles heel, and his was that he was so paralyzed by his concern with whether what he was doing with that was ethical that he essentially drove everyone crazy. He just made everyone around him miserable because he could, someone would say like, let's go get something to eat, and then he would have to look at the menu and weigh the ethical degrees to which, whether you should order salmon or tuna fish or whatever. So that is a Kantian kind of person, I think, is the person who believes that there's a right answer to every question and is in constant search for that right answer and then makes everyone around him miserable.
Very well said. Fans of The Good Place will be well aware of the trolley problem. Why is this philosophy's most famous thought experiment?
Well, it was invented in 1967 by a woman named Philippa Foot, who is a British philosopher, and it is still, philosophy 101 classes often start with the trolley problem today.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
I think the reason that it's so popular is because in both situations, something bad happens. And I think there is something about modern life where that touches a nerve, right? Because we are often in situations where the reason they're tough to figure out is because in both versions of what you do, something bad will result. And so I don't know if this was intentional on Philippa Foot's part or any of the people who have written about it since, but that to me is what it really taps into is that, look, if the choice is, do you run over five people or do you pull a lever to stop the train? Well, there's no ethical dilemma there, right? Of course, you stop the trolley. But yeah. because in both scenarios, there's a result that makes it a little bit like you're sick to your stomach with what happened. That is much more reflective of the sorts of ethical dilemmas that we find ourselves in all the time. And my guess is that's why we're still talking about it.
Michael, you've been kind of quiet. What do you think about all this?
Well, obviously the dilemma is clear. How do you kill all six people? So I would dangle a sharp blade out the window to slice the neck of the guy on the other track as we smoosh our five main guys. Oh, I did the thing again, didn't I?
Yep. 10 more, buddy.
People good. People good. Why is that so hard?
You address these heavy concepts with a lot of humor. How are you able to do that, or does that just kind of come naturally to you?
Well, that is my professional job, you know?
Yes,
So I've been doing it since 98 is when I started at Saturday Night Live, and I you know, it's the thing that I've been doing my whole life. So I find that humor is the most effective delivery mechanism for any kind of information or moral lesson or anything. Like, you know, on Parks and Recreation, we were talking about government, specifically local government, which is a pretty dry subject. But our bet, Greg Daniels and I created the show together, and our bet was that just like with The Office, set in a very mundane, you know, fluorescent light cubicle little universe, that if you are funny enough that you can get your message across and people will be, if people are entertained, they'll listen to what you have to say. So it's both just sort of what my job is. And also I truly believe it's the best way to convey information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think you're exactly right. Especially with such a like heady subject as philosophy, it really, really works well. And you did a magnificent job of that and made the book that much more entertaining and relevant to us, I think. Of course, we can't really talk about philosophy without discussing the hot new philosophical term everyone is talking about, Michael Schur's moral exhaustion. What is moral exhaustion, and how did you, Michael Schur, come up with this idea?
First of all, thank you for phrasing the question that way. In the book, I write about moral this term I'm trying to coin called moral exhaustion, and I capitalize it everywhere in the book because, as I say in a footnote, this might be my only chance to have like a cool term that enters the academic culture, and I'm really pushing for it to catch on so that in the future, thousands of years from now, there will be an alien classroom and aliens will say, who invented moral exhaustion? Oh, it was that genius Michael Schur. So what I'm referring to is a couple things that are encompassed in that term. One of them is the fact that because of the way the world works now, because of the internet, because of Twitter and Facebook and everybody has a camera phone, we are constantly being bombarded with moral questions and ethical questions in a way we never have been before. Every time a man enters a smoothie store somewhere and goes on some kind of weird racist rant and throws a smoothie at an employee, everyone across the globe instantly sees it and knows it and is sort of being asked to weigh in a moral way, right? You're being asked to judge that person's ethical behavior. That didn't used to be the case. And because we see 50 of these things a day, it can be really exhausting to feel like every single moment of your life is being phrased or sort of proffered in like an ethical or moral question. And then there's the flip side of that, which is that because we know all this information about people who are famous and not famous, we are constantly being asked to make judgments about our own lives in terms of, well, this director of movies was just revealed to be a weird creep. Do you still support his movies? Do you still watch his movies? Do you still pay for his movies? This actor or this singer or this athlete is problematic in a different way. Are you still going to root for that team? Are you going to look at that person's paintings? Like, it becomes exhausting to constantly check in and weigh in and have to decide whether or not you still support them or you still will watch their movies or listen to their music.
Hey, babe. Great news. I got us tickets to the Coyotes game.
Awesome.
But, ooh, yikes. Turns out two of the players have DUIs. Guess we can't cheer for that team.
Eleanor.
You know what? Instead, let's just stay in, watch a Roman Polanski movie, listen to R. Kelly, and eat Chick-fil-A. Does that sound good? There's bad stuff everywhere, man. It's impossible to avoid.
Yeah, but shouldn't we just try? Shouldn't we just try to do the right thing whenever we can?
Why? It's so much harder to live like that, and it's not like someone's keeping score.
That sense of exhaustion, of never getting a break from the questions of whether what you're doing in something as small and personal as what music you listen to or what movies you see, you're constantly now being asked to weigh in with yourself at least about whether or not it's okay that you're still doing that. So that's what I'm trying to encapsulate with the hot new philosophy term, moral exhaustion.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that Woody Allen was a big influence on you, and like sort of influenced you to pursue comedy, and then now you have to reckon with, you know, the misbehavior of him, but you can still appreciate his films, right?
Yes, that's the example I give in the book, is Woody Allen was incredibly important to me. Like, my sense of humor, it's not unfair to say that my sense of humor was formed by watching Sleeper and Annie Hall and Take the Money and Run and all of those great comedies from the 70s. And then, you know, a bunch of other stuff happens where you learn about his relationship with Soon-Yi Previn, and you learn about the allegations made against him involving abuse of a minor. And then when that happens, you go back and you think about some of those movies. You think about the movie Manhattan, in which he is a 43-year-old guy who's having an intimate relationship with a 16-year-old high school student. And in real life, Mariel Hemingway, who played that role, was 16 years old. And when she kissed him in that movie, it was the first time she had ever kissed another human being. And that power dynamic is pretty plainly not okay. If you did that now, if you were a 43-year-old director and you wrote a story about having a relationship with a 16-year-old and you cast a 16-year-old and you made out with that 16-year-old in Central Park, I think people would have a very different reaction to it than they had in 1984 or whatever it was, or 1980, I can't remember now, when Woody Allen made Manhattan. So I have been forced in my life to try to reckon with the fact that the guy who was more than maybe anybody else, it's really Woody Allen and Monty Python were the two biggest people for me. And now I have to reckon with the fact that that guy is very suspect and problematic, and it's hard. It's not like there's no right answer here. There's no there's no solution to this problem. It's, you know, what I say in the book is you kind of just have to keep both of those things in your head at the same time. This person is very important to me and was formative in the way that I, you know, learned about the world and grew up and formed a personality. And also, this person is problematic and has done some things that I think are unforgivable. And that is not a great place to live. It takes all the fun out of watching that person's movies. Like, you can't just shut your half of your brain off like a dolphin, you know, and only focus on half of that equation. I think you kind of just have to wrestle with it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. One of my favorite things about philosophy is the thought experiment. So I thought we would finish off with the thought experiment. If you're
great,
okay,
yes, absolutely.
Okay,
thought experiments are my favorite part too. So hit me.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. If you had created The Good Place after you wrote your book, How to Be Perfect, in what ways, if any, would The Good Place be a different show?
Wow. I think it wouldn't be as good, honestly, because the joy of making television is that it's collaborative. There has never yet been a comedy writer who can do it all him or herself. It doesn't exist. And the real joy of it is you have an idea and you work on your idea, and then you invite into the room a bunch of really smart and funny people who think in ways that you don't, who pitch jokes in a way that you can't, and then you hire actors who translate those jokes and lines of dialogue into actual moments of human interconnectedness. And you have directors and you have lighting operators and camera operators and props people and costumes people and location managers and all of these people who contribute in some way to making the thing that you, your idea, better.
I want to broaden my horizons and try new things, and I will. But even though I might have gotten lost in the weeds, I loved writing this book, and I want to try again. So, will you be my advisor?
Chidi, all I want is for you to be happy. So if spending eternity getting blunt feedback on your circular rambling ideas will make you happy, then of course I will be your advisor. Let's throw that monstrosity in the trash and start over.
Aren't there maybe some parts worth salvaging?
Honestly, man, I don't even know. I mean, that thing is unreadable. I literally learned what headaches were because that thing gave me a headache.
And I believe that I have a much greater understanding of the world of ethics because I worked first on a collaborative project where it was a discussion, a conversation, a daily conversation about not just humor and not just plot, but really like wrestling with those topics. I think that if I had written the book first and it was like, this is my pure solo version and understanding of this material and then had gone into the show, I think it's possible that I would have been less open to that collaboration because I would feel like, well, I know all this stuff. I wrote a book about this stuff. Nobody can teach me anything about this, right? So I think that the way it happened is the most effective and organic way for it to happen, which is it's a collaboration first, and then out of that comes my personal understanding of the results of that collaboration.
What a great answer. Thank you. That thought experiment, your answer was much better than the actual thought experiment. Thank you. No, seriously, it was. I was trying to think, was that good enough thought experiment? My boss, Adam Friedrich, said, yeah, that's good. Michael Schur, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on How to Be Perfect. It's funny, informative, inspiring, and philosophical, just like you. And congratulations on Moral Exhaustion. It's going to go viral by the end of the day if it hasn't already. Seriously, it's such a timely idea. You've come
great.
Up with the right,
use that,
the perfect
use that
idea
hashtag.
At the time.
Everybody, yeah. Hashtag moral exhaustion, and we'll
yes,
see if
indeed.
We can get it trending.
That's what we're going to do when we tweet about this interview. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Schur is the author of How to Be Perfect, the correct answer to every moral question. He's also the creator of The Good Place. You can find out more about Michael and moral exhaustion at wpr.org/beta.
How amazing, how cool to take a risk and have the chance to bring their voices to readers who might then, you know, if I'm lucky, look them up online and learn a little bit something about how radical women really have always been.
Coming up, Gwen Kirby talks about her short story collection, which focuses on fierce, funny, and powerful women. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.